and Human Services will now come to order. Today is Monday, April 30th, and what I will do is ask Mr. Britton to go over a two-week agenda, and after that, introduce some action for today's activities. Thank you guys very much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, we've placed a typical two-week agenda in front of you. Today, as you'll see, we have a work session on three federal grant application requests. We'll try and move that along fairly quickly. DHS is here to make some presentations, three presentations on those grants. Then we'll continue our public hearing on House Bill 5031, Seniors and People with Disabilities, focusing on services to persons with developmental disabilities. Today, tomorrow, Wednesday, we have scheduled public testimony on services to persons with developmental disabilities. And on Friday, May 3rd, a program area wrap-up for seniors and people with disabilities. Next week, tentatively scheduled, we now have the final major program area within the Department of Human Services, department-wide support services, on Monday, May 7th, Tuesday, May 8th. In addition, on May 8th, public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2186 relating to set-off of liquidated debts. Wednesday, May 9th, finish up with department-wide support services, and on Thursday, May 10th, a discussion of department program priorities and reduction options. So that's what we have on tap for the next 2 weeks. With that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it back to you. We have three federal grant applications, and as I said, DHS is prepared to talk about each one.
Okay, can you come forward?
Madam Chair, Madeline Olson is here from Mental Health Services, and Ms. Catherine Bradley is here on behalf of Public Health, and I would suggest we start with the Mental Health Grant first.
Ms. Olson?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Madeline Olson, the Deputy Assistant Director for the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to talk with you about our request to apply for a mental health data infrastructure grant for the quality improvement. They're known by the feds as state DIG grants. This is another grant in a series of federally funded efforts to support the states in preparing for what will be happening in the next federal fiscal year, and that's the reporting to the federal government of the national outcome measures which are required for our mental health block grant. With this grant, we'll be using the resources to address local and state concerns related to the infrastructure that will support those reporting the required performance and outcome measures, and to strengthen our ability to collect the annual uniform reporting system measures. So, and those are used, like I said, to support the block grant, both in the application and the report, and are available and form the backbone of our outcome reporting that we do for all of the system, as well as that which is federally funded. The grant is a little over $426,200 over the course of 3 years. With the grant that's just ending September 7th, we have done a number of things that are positioning us to look to the future for our data reporting. One is to develop a web-based reporting system, which we're testing with in-house staff now. And with the new grant, we'll finalize the development of that system and open it up to all of our community partners, which will allow them to query data and get online reports of services in their community. The other thing we've done with the current grant is the beginning processes of the planning that led to our ability to define for you during our budget presentation the replacement of the current state data system, the project that we talked to you about known as BHIP, which I recall some of you liked the name of. So that's what we've done, and we'll continue to do that process. We do all of the work with contractors as opposed to state staff, and what support requirements are done with currently funded positions. So if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I'm very happy to see you guys. I'm very happy to see you doing this because we've wondered for a long time how do you have an accountability from your local partners and how we can expect some outcomes that we can look at and say this program has been very effective and go forward with it. We don't have that data, so I'm really glad to see this here. Further discussion. Representative Morgan, and then Senator Bates.
Thank you. I'm just concerned with the retroactive nature of one of these grants, and it says that the Department of Administrative Services provided the DHS grant materials to the Legislative Fiscal Office on April 16th. And I think this is a question for Mr. Britton. First of all, can you tell us what the policy, the LFO policy, is around the timeliness of grant submissions and how that relates to this?
Madam Chair and Representative Morgan, I will address your question. This particular mental health grant is not being approved today retroactively. It's due on May 3rd. But the other two grants, you're right. And before I continue, this grant will be approved retroactively by the full Ways and Means Committee, presumably, if you want it to go ahead. The other two grants are being approved retroactively, and I would take the fault for not getting these processed in a timely way. I believe that the Department of Human Services got them to DAS as soon as they could, and DAS got them to us. I haven't had time to process them, so that's why they are retroactive in nature.
Thank you. For the discussion, Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me what are the environmental hazards you're trying to address here? Well, what is actually going on with this program?
Let's get clear on which one of these we're talking about.
We're on the Department of Human Services Mental Health.
My mistake.
All right. We'll come back to you when we get to that one. Okay. Further discussion on the mental health that they are trying to get a request, which is to recommend those approval. Further discussion?
Same one on the environmental one.
Any objections?
You want a motion? We have a motion?
Yes. Senator Chair?
I move adoption of the Department of Human Services Health Services Grant. Submission of the federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, in the amount of up to $426,200 over 3 years to improve mental health services performance and outcome data reporting.
Senator Gordon moves the approval of the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration in the amount of $426,200 over the next 3 years to improve mental health services performance and outcome data reporting. Any objection?
Madam Chair and members, I would suggest then that we move to the grant that Senator Bates had a question about, and that is the one related to the $150,000 over 18 months to address environmental health hazards among pregnant women.
Ms. Bradley?
Thank you, Chair Carter and Committee. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm Administrator for the Office of Family Health, which will oversee both these grants that we're suggesting today. The first one on building capacity for environmental health, this was an opportunity that we saw to move forward and expand our environmental health program that has been fairly limited and predominantly focused on lead. And with the funding that would be available, we would be looking at developing a larger cohort of knowledge around education on multiple environmental health hazards, specifically mercury, lead, tobacco smoke, reducing exposures to hazardous chemicals, pesticides, drinking water contamination, and indoor and outdoor work or hobby-related environmental hazards. The purpose of this grant is to develop a new environmental health assessment tool and to expand environmental health training for public health nurses to use on home visits with pregnant women. The funding will be used to do a review of the literature and provide a develop a new tool based on best practices. We will pilot it in 3 counties, providing education for public health nurses in those counties, and an evaluation process that will assess both the education for the public health nurses and changes in practice for the pregnant mothers. It's being implemented through the Maternity Case Management Program, which is our public health home visiting program, where the public health nurses work with pregnant mothers and are funded for a total of 8 visits. And the intent then is that education would occur with the client, and there would be follow-up reinforcement and evaluation about whether changes occurred. At the completion of this 18-month grant, we would then have hopefully a tool and a pilot that we would then be able to implement statewide across our maternity case management program, having a standing way to do education with public health nurses that would be useful across all of our state. And I will be glad to entertain any questions.
Representative Garrard?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know what 3 counties you're going to do the pilot programs in?
The process that we have established with the county local health organizations is that when we get approval of a grant, we actually send out an RFP with the criteria and allow the counties then to request an interest, so we don't predetermine those.
Senator Benz?
She answered my questions.
Senator Benz? Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you provide us with the list of environmental hazards, and also is mold included in those hazards?
Chair Carter and Senator Winters, what I read to you was a brief outline of the most probable causes, but we'll provide you with a list, and if there are other indicators that need to be added on, we certainly will.
Would you take a look and see if mold is included?
I will.
Representative Legison?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was along the lines that have already been raised. In applying for this, is the motivation because we want to very simply do a better job? And don't get me wrong, I think this is a great idea. Or has there been some evidence that we have seen problems? Are we trying to fix some problems that we know exist out there? Babies, either young infants or babies being born that have been subject to inappropriate levels of harmful exposure. So are we solving a problem that exists now? And then the second question is, it sounds great that the grant requires no matching funds from the state or additional positions, but if the intent is to potentially develop a statewide tool, who would be developing that? Is the department telling us that they can absorb the work of that either in the current or in the next biennium, just within existing positions, developing this statewide tool?
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson, thank you very much for your questions. Let me take the second one first, and then I'll work back. The intent of this is that the work that actually needs to get done is the investigation, the development of the tool, and the development of the teaching modalities, and then testing that out and fine-tuning that. Then our ability to incorporate that into an existing program and into the existing orientation can be easily absorbed. So it really is doing the upfront work, developing the educational component. We actually do have a fair amount of significant in-kind contribution to this. As is typical in most of our grants, the amount of in-kind contribution equals or exceeds what the federal government is actually granting us. That's actually a fairly practical application. They like to see that. So that I can tell you that we do have a significant amount of investment, both from the environmental health side and then also from our office as well.
Madam Chair. Senator Boardman and Representative Morgan.
Thank you very much. I have several questions for you, and good afternoon. Do we know how many women we expect to reach through the grant? Pregnant women?
Senator Carter, Carter and Senator Gorley, if I can briefly, I forgot to respond to one of Representative Nathanson's first question, if I can take that first. The question was whether this is a real need or not. One of the frequent concerns we've had raised from our public health nurses in the field is the need for environmental health education. That's not been a resource that we've been able to provide. So while we do not have current data on the number of impacts it's had on our clients that we've served, we do have a very real, we've had a long standing history of requests from the field from our nurses that we wanted to respond to. In relationship to the number of people, Senator Gordley, you might be able to reach, in 2006, the Maternity Case Management Program provided care to over 56,000 pregnant women statewide, which was approximately 11% of Oregon births. And they conducted over 8,000 client and home assessments during 16,000 visits. So this is a very effective program, which is our baseline for reaching pregnant women, and we think is a very appropriate application through this group.
And we think, you think that you might be able to reach how many women?
Based on last year, we were able to reach the mothers of approximately 11% of Oregon births.
Okay. Follow-up, Madam Chair. Is this grant in any way tied to the concern that we have raised here and the conversation that we've had with you around the incidence of low birth weight babies? Can you talk about the connection to the grant?
Senator Carter and Senator Gorley, what I would say is that I think this grant is very specifically targeted for many of our families that have to deal with health disparities, whether that is racial or, quite honestly, rural and frontier area health disparities where we don't have the resources. We don't have direct link information that specifically speaks to low-weight births, but it certainly is an understanding that our maternity case management specifically targets women who are at risk for having adverse pregnancy outcomes, and so we see that this is an appropriate vehicle
to look at those issues.
Yes.
And then one last question, Madam Chair. Recently there have been reports in newspapers, the Oregonian, the Portland Tribune, about the high incidence of air pollution rates along the I-84 corridor, the I-5 corridor, and the fact that that presents a significant health risk to folks who live near a freeway. And I'm wondering if, given what you said about this being an opportunity to look at environmental health information and how these different environmental health issues also impact pregnancies, if there's anyone looking at the connection or the opportunity to look at that kind of information and the purpose of the grant.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, this grant actually allows an opportunity for us to have staff from two areas work together and bring in their joint expertise. So it actually does jointly do some funding with our environmental health staff as well as with our maternity case management staff. So we feel that we've put together sort of the right kind of a partnership. We do have within environmental health an epidemiology unit that tracks and monitors environmental issues across the state. What we have not had the opportunity to do is to really develop a joint project that would allow us to take their knowledge and expertise and apply it to something very practical as a tool that can be used in the field.
Mm-hmm. And so, last question, Madam Chair. Would this grant allow you to be able to do that kind of partnering?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, yes, it would.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Morgan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Help me understand this. Right now, public health nurses are going up and doing home visits. What would trigger a home visit by a public health nurse? Why would a person be receiving a visit?
Chair Cardner and Representative Morgan, thank you very much. The predominant referrals that we have for our prenatal care really come from the physicians who see a client in their office that they feel needs more care and attention and follow-up in terms of health behaviors than they're able to provide. So our program, which is about 16 years old, has been contracted and approved through Medicaid, through DMAP, for 8 to 10 visits that start prenatally and run for 2 months after delivery. And the focus is around health education and changing lifestyle. They go in, they do an environmental assessment that's very limited right now without really the education that enables them to do more than just an initial assessment. But they're predominantly assessing for health hazards and then engaging them in education. Tobacco cessation, drinking drugs, nutrition, and then on the basis of the assessment and the care plan that's put in place, they work with the primary provider in terms of follow-up and ongoing education, reinforcement, as well as making arrangements sometimes, for example, for a nutritionist to visit or to provide a linkage for other county services.
So if I might have a follow-up, what happens at this stage, right? What happens right now if a nurse goes into a home and there's sewage all over the floor? What does the nurse do about that immediate environmental threat at this point in time?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, I think our public health nurses, as most of our social service workers throughout DHS, if they walked into a client's home and saw that there was something that was at such a high level of risk, they would work within the community to try and do something about that. The question usually is, are there other resources? Are there other locations? Is there some other community funding? What are the linkages? It's fairly typical, I think, for any of our DHS folks who go into a home setting and see something at pretty high risk for a client that they try and find some other ways of bringing other community resources to them.
So would you, under that kind of a situation, bring in someone from the public health side of your operation to kind of try to figure out what's going on and what to do about it? Or do you just call a plumber? Or how do you deal with this functionally?
Chip Carter and Representative Morgan, it actually probably would go back to, a discussion with a nursing supervisor and a discussion about what are some other county resources to pull on. That wouldn't necessarily just be within the domain of public health. And I think most typically at the county level, what you get is, you know, multiple services trying to work together to figure it out. It's not that someone has the funding to pull in a plumber, but what are some other ways to access services or to access some funding pots that can be available to that individual.
And you don't have this already? I mean, having done these things for years and years, you haven't put together a system of support to help get to the bottom of those kinds of environmental problems?
Chair Carter and Representative Morgan, it isn't that it's not in existence, but I think some of the education for the more typical things aren't there. For example, in some of our rural communities, someone comes in at the end of a work day and they bring there and they walk in and they have clothes that may be covered with from a farming area, from agricultural, with pesticides or something like that because they work out in the fields. Maybe teaching the mother that a better way to do that is to work with her partner to leave their boots outside the house, to find a way to have clothes that come off before they come into the house. There really are assessments about helping people to understand they're actually being exposed daily to environmental risks and what are some ways that they can go about exploring how they can take on the role of being the advocate in their family and being responsible for their family more appropriately in terms of environmental problems. Having a discussion about secondhand smoke, if that's an issue within the family. Having a discussion about air quality, if that's a concern, or about mold. What are ways that we can make sure that the public health nurses have enough education and knowledge around specifics about the community resources as well so that they can actually help that parent then be an advocate for that family. So I think that's really the way we see the translation of it. Right now, it's just very individual. There are folks out there that have wonderful knowledge and are able to implement it, but in many of our cases, it's not there. And what this program would provide is, you know, more standardized information and an understanding to really reinforce that support for the public health nurse.
The final question, there's a piece here that says, and to intervene when necessary. What does that mean?
Senator Carter and Representative Morgan, I think that there is a level of risk assessment that goes on with any DHS worker that goes into a home, that if they see a situation that is a high enough level of concern, and if change doesn't occur, that they begin to seek other community resources for intervention. And so I think that if you're in a family situation where you see children that may potentially be at risk, it still would be the responsibility of that nurse then to report that back to their supervisor and for that to be explored. And that would be a very high-level risk, and probably the best example might be sewage in the home that was not resolved. That is a risk that needs not to continue. But I think that's a responsibility that any of our staff have when they come in contact with families.
Any discussion? Would you like a motion?
Yes, ma'am. Madam Chair, I move to approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency Office of Children's Health Protection and Environmental Education, Child and Aging Health Division, in the amount of up to $150,000 over 18 months to address environmental health hazards among pregnant women.
Move that we accept the request aforementioned. Are there any objections? So ordered. Mr. Bittner?
Madam Chair, the last grant is also a public health grant request for $625,000 over 5 years.
Discussion?
I move the LFO request.
Chair Carter and committee, this is part of a series of grants that we have been working for over the last couple of years, getting funding from the federal government to support the development of the FamilyNet Integrated Maternal and Child Health Data System. This was a new opportunity that came about at a particularly auspicious time because it talks about and gives us an example to potentially apply for funding that supports the concept of what's called interoperability. And the best example that I have of that is that at the county level, when counties collect immunization data for their records, it needs to be entered into our alert registry system. However, many of them have already entered that information for the first time into their own county systems, and then they have to duplicate that and enter it a second time into the state system. And so the desire of the counties and the conversations we've been having with them over the last year is that we work on technology solutions to this so the data can be entered at the county system, and then there's a way to have that linked appropriately to a state system. Last year, we did an information technology survey of our local public health departments, and we found there were five major vendor systems that were in use, as well as several homegrown systems. And what we do believe and recognize is that we need to support our public health agencies at the local level in making the right decisions for them about what's the right technology tools to use. So the burden then falls then currently at the state level for us to work with them in terms of providing the leadership to provide technology solutions that will be financially feasible. This is part of probably what will continue to be a series of grants where we look for federal funding to help us bring in contractors to work with our county partners, do an assessment of the situation, provide some recommended resolutions, and then we have a better sense at both the state and at the county level about what it will take for us to continue to move forward. This uses existing staff that we currently are using within the program, and this would not require an obligation, nor would we be coming back for funding from the state, because we do just consider this to be part of the developing, ongoing development of what we're trying to do with our data systems.
Discussion?
Just a question of the
answer. What is the prospect of the approval from CDC?
Senator Carter and Chair Carter, Senator Winters, we are, I think this round of grants, there are seven grants that are being granted, I think we submitted a very strong grant. So I would like to think that we would be approved. If it is not approved, this work will be moving forward just at a much slower pace because we won't have some of the funding that would enable us to do that.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. So have you had conversation with CDC respecting the grant application?
Chair Carter, Senator Winters, yes, we have. We have been involved in these CDC assessment grants in the past and have a good track record behind that, so we did understood that this would be received favorably.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Given the testimony that we've just heard, I'd like to say back what I think I heard. It's a paraphrase, and if I'm mistaken, I hope I will be corrected by staff. It sounds to me that what's described to us is a technology solution to avoid redundant data.
entry. So this will be a benefit to the state because we'll be able to better monitor outcomes, but it's also an important benefit to counties who are already strapped for time and trying to be able to meet demands. And I'd like to be able to describe it that way of a real tangible benefit to counties, if that is indeed the case.
Chair Carter, Representative Nathanson, you very eloquently framed that. We did receive a letter of support from CLO for this, and they were pleased to see that there might be an opportunity for some funding that would assist us, because this will take a partnership from both the county and the state to look at these solutions. Thank you.
Further discussion, Madam Chair. Senator Bates and then Senator Bordray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This talks about exchanging client data from county and private providers. The question being, what kind of data would be shared, and how do private providers share that data? In addition, the information apparently goes to policymakers and program managers, so the kind of data being shared and how you're picking it up, it seems kind of germane to me. Is it by individual or is it group information? I mean, what are you looking at here?
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, thank you very much. The data under the FamilyNet data system is actually in several different programs, so that specific one speaks to immunizations. Private providers administer immunizations, and they enter it into the data system. It's actually less of a problem for the private providers as it is more for the county health systems, where they see a large volume of clients and enter their data into their county health system and then have to turn around and re-enter it. So it's that level. It is individual-level data. It's specific to the program. So our WIC program is part of this. The Women, Infant, and Children's Nutrition Program, they have their own data system. The immunization data system is a part of this. The early hearing detection and intervention system, EDI, which collects hearing data on newborns from our hospitals, is a part of the system, and our maternal child health home visiting programs are a part of this. So each of the different programs have information that comes in and is maintained then based on appropriate protocols in terms of security requirements. And I think the best example of that you're probably most familiar with, again, is with ALERT. There are restrictions on how data is accessed, who can access it, and to what level. Does that help with your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Partially, I mean, obviously some of these programs are excellent. Immunization program especially stands out. But I'm just a little concerned about home health visits and what data might get in there and how that data might be shared at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
There's some privacy issues that I'm sure you're looking at. I just want some reassurance you're looking at those.
Chair Carter and Senator Bates, we are very well aware of privacy issues and standards. The data that we collect is maintained in regards, I think, to current security issues, and we work very closely with our Attorney General's office to make sure that we're current in terms of how that's managed. With home visiting, it is client-level data as well, that data is stored at the county level. It's shared then at the state level and at the state level. Program evaluation assessment is done on aggregate data, and we have standing policies about who can access data and who can't, and we actually used our partners at DMAP as the model for that because they have pretty rigid standards on how data can and cannot be accessed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. The co-chairs cut $5 million out of public health in their budget. In what ways would that cut affect implementation of this grant?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, it has a very real impact in that what this grant will do is identify what the possible solutions are that need to occur. It still then will be the responsibility at the county level for changes to be made in their technology structure and for them to carry the financial burden for that. So that would be an example where the lack of funding may delay their ability to implement that, and that $5 million is very applicable to that. I've had conversations over the last couple of months
with the public health administrator in Benton County, in Deschutes County, in Jackson County, and I just recently was down on a week-long visit down in Douglas, and the need for better information technology exchange that is in a less costly burden at the county level, but better understanding so that they can do the kind of assessment and program evaluation is very high on all of their needs, and those are conversations I've had with all four administrators in the last couple of months.
Given your response, if I may follow up, Madam Chair, given your response then, how successful are we going to be in our grant application if one of the things we're also communicating to them is that we may face a cut of $5 million to public health? Is that information that's being shared with the the CDC?
Chair Carter and Senator Gordley, I don't know that they would necessarily be aware of that level of detail in Oregon. And I also believe that this is important work. One of the requirements of the grant is that we're actually modeling something that can be shared with other states. And we think that this work is important modeling for actually other parts of public health, like emergency preparedness, as well as for other states. And I think that would be the level they would be looking at.
Okay. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Would you like a motion?
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, I move to approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Centers for Disease Control in an amount of up to $625,000 over 5 years to improve public health data systems.
Representative Nathanson moved the request to approve retroactively the submission of a federal grant application to the U.S. Department of Health. Are there any objections?
Madam Chair, not an objection, but I'm just wondering out loud if the co-chairs were aware at all of the unintended consequences of their cut to public health, this being one example.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
could Representative Matheson read that motion again? It was so long, I forgot.
Are there any objections to this motion for the request? Thank you very much. Motion carried.
Madam Chair, we need carriers for each of these grants.
Volunteer on the House side.
Full committee.
Are there volunteers on the House side? Representative Matheson, thank you. On the Senate side?
Well, I'd volunteer, but I'd probably be taking the wrong one on, you know.
On the Senate side.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much.
Full. Well, they just need to go to full.
Yeah, to full. Is that something else? Yeah.
Well, they don't go through the chambers. They just are approved at full. So we need one carrier for each of them.
In the world.
Who is a member of full committee?
Oh, that's right. Naples and Gordon.
Okay.
All
three of
us. Good. Yeah, they will do that.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Bitten. I'd like to now open the public hearing on House Bill 5031 and invite Mr. Hayes and company up.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, we're pleased to be back this week. James Taves from the Senior and Disability Program at the Department of Human Services, and I have with me Mary Lee Fay, who administers the Developmental Disabilities Program, and we're going to spend the next 2 days on the developmental disability portion of the overall Senior and Disability Program. Just by way of context, the overall budget for the Senior Disability Program for the biennium is about $2.8 billion, of which just a shade over $1 billion is for the developmental disability population. Just by way of introduction, if you look at the chart on page 46 in your book, I wanted to describe very briefly the major trends that have characterized the developmental disabilities program over really the past 25, 30 years. And it seems like almost every decade we've made some pretty dramatic changes and how the whole developmental disability service system operates. Really, until the 1970s, Oregon, like most states, spent almost all of its money in state institutions, and other than that, families were left pretty much to fend for themselves, with maybe a scattering of sheltered workshops in the state. In the early 70s, 1973 was the benchmark year when special education for people with developmental disabilities was mandated. It was the first year where the legislature authorized the creation of a network of community-based services as well. And those services slowly began to grow through the 70s. However, virtually all of our budget was still tied up in institutional services. In 1981, the Oregon legislature passed legislation that directed us to dramatically change the paradigm and to begin to move people out of institutions aggressively and to really begin to bolster our community system as the primary setting where people with disabilities should live. That legislation was passed in 1981. Throughout the 80s, every biennium, the department brought in proposals to further reduce our institutional census. However, the vast resources were still spent in institutional care. In the late 80s, the federal government intervened in major ways in Oregon. The United States Department of Justice filed suit. And ultimately, in the late 80s, 1989, Oregon signed a consent decree, which lasted all the way till 2001 with the U.S. Department of Justice. CMS came into the state multiple times, pulled all the federal money out of our institutions temporarily because of major issues with care and inadequate staffing and facilities. So beginning in the early 90s, Oregon embarked on a further pretty dramatic course. One, in the early 90s, who basically froze admissions to state institutions and created a whole crisis network to support people even with complex needs in the community. And really, when you shut the front door of an institution, that's really the closure date as opposed to when the last person leaves, because it really redirects your entire service system. And throughout the 90s, we had multiple discussions in the Oregon legislature about continued downsizing, eventual closure. Both the 95, 97, and 99 sessions had some pretty difficult discussions, and then finally in 1999, the legislature directed us to close our last large remaining institution, Fairview Training Center, which was closed in April of 2001. So that really then put Oregon, I think we're 11th in the country in our lowest per capita rate of institutionalization. Nine of the states that are ahead of us have no people with developmental disabilities left in institutions. So we're actually ranked very close. We only have 40 people left at Eastern Oregon Training Center, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. But Oregon has one of the lowest institutional rates in the country. Then, beginning in 2000, we took another dramatic turn. We settled a large class action lawsuit called the Staley lawsuit. At that point, we had probably 4,000 or 5,000 people with disabilities on waiting lists all over the state. We had spent almost all our resources and efforts in downsizing the institution while families and people with disabilities patiently waited, or not so patiently waited at times in the community. We settled the lawsuit in 2001. We brought the first iteration of that settlement to the 2001 Oregon legislature. And essentially what we did in return for rolling out the Staley Agreement, which is non-24-hour support, is support to individuals and to families, which we'll talk about in some detail, but it's non-residential, non-group home, non-24-hour support. And we agreed with the plaintiffs it was a rather painful decision for them to really maintain a pretty tight cap on the growth of 24-hour care so that we could really shift funds pretty dramatically into in-home supports and community supports, with the goal being that we would eventually be able to provide at least some level of support to every single person in the state without any waiting lists. The original lawsuit settlement was to have ended in 2005. During the special sessions of 2003-2005, we renegotiated that, extended it till the end of the 2007-2009 biennium. So by the end of this coming biennium, we will have completely rolled out that settlement. So you can see on that chart, In a 24-hour system, your institutional services are declining and almost non-existent. Residential services have been held fairly constant, and the big growth then is in support to individuals and their families still living at home. And now we really face kind of the next iteration of our system. We have large numbers of people, I'm sure you'll hear about it during the public testimony, large numbers of adults with developmental disabilities living in many cases with aging parents. They've been able to benefit from the Staley lawsuit and getting some in-home benefits, but we've really sort of choked off the growth of that service, and we have a lot of people that will be in the queue needing and wanting 24-hour and expanded supports in the next couple of years. And we also have some significant infrastructure issues which we propose to address in part in this budget in terms of staff turnover, provider wages, which I'm sure you've heard about as well, that we will describe in more detail. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the 25-30-year history of the developmental disability system that I think is moving very dramatically and very positively in Oregon and compared to most other states, but the cracks in the system are really beginning to show, and we're certainly going to describe those cracks to you and indicate the ways in this budget that we begin to repair those issues. So with that, I'll unless there's any questions, I'll just turn it over to Mary Lee.
Questions to Mr. Tate? Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. This is probably a question I should have asked last week, but this seems like a good juncture to do it, because I've been trying to understand the system, and I was thinking of children who might not be eligible for PD services but have physical disabilities, and I'm just wondering how you serve those children up to 18. If they are served by, they're probably not served by this system, the developmental disabilities, because they were qualified, but they have a disability. I'm just trying to figure out where certain types of individuals fall in your system.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, we don't do a great job of serving kids with disabilities in this state. We've done a much better job with adults. And what we did some years ago is all of children's services were under the sort of the child welfare portion of the department. And I think in the mid-90s, we then moved developmental disabilities over to the long-term care side. With that, we've developed, and Mary Lee will describe, some waivers in which we serve some ventilator-dependent and some very medically fragile kids that aren't necessarily DD eligible in the classic sense. And in fact, some of the kids we serve are pretty bright kids that are technology-dependent. And certainly at Providence and some of the nursing facilities, we've ended up serving kids with physical and other disabilities. But again, short of DD services, there's a small outreach to the rest of those populations, but not a real rich mix of services for them, other than special education, obviously.
A follow-up, Madam Chair,
please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that response, I guess. So my question would be, how do we improve on that? Is it a, I'm sure it's always a resource issue to some degree, but is it a, how we've set up the systems? I know a lot of things have changed. You know, disabilities are in SPD, but, you know, does it make sense to maybe serve those children a different division? What do you think the answer is to kind of fill in that gap for those children who don't fit in these particular slots?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I wouldn't really suggest a different part of the department, because certainly on the senior side and the physical disability side, we see our mission as really looking at functional disabilities as opposed to pigeonholing people in sort of categorical diagnoses. So I would see our mission over time in serving more and more non-DD, other types of disabilities with children. Certainly Representative Gelser has some legislation. We have contemplated submitting additional federal waivers of that, where we would waive against the Medicaid portion of our nursing home population, which of course goes across all disabilities potentially. So I think there are different federal vehicles to do that. I think we would certainly see that as part of our mission. It ultimately does become a resource issue.
And I would be supportive of those efforts if we could do that, because, you know, the goal is to support the family, try to keep the child at home, but I know that we haven't really set up the funding that way, so we have to go after it. Thank you.
Any further questions? Please continue.
So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to turn over to Mary Lou Fay.
He's improving.
Right. Chair Westland, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm the Seniors and People with Disabilities and the Administrator for Developmental Disability Services. The material I'm going to be referring to today starts on page 40, and what I'm hoping to do today and into tomorrow is give an overview of what the services are for people with developmental disabilities, how they're organized. I'd like to talk about some of our performance measure outcomes, and then move into the issues that are facing the field and some of our policy option packages. As James mentioned, with the instituting the STALEY services, we think about services to people with developmental disabilities in two ways. One is through our comprehensive services, and one is through supports. Individuals that we serve are children and adults, and they fall into one of those two categories if they're in service. So let me start, first of all, with comprehensive services. Comprehensive services refers to the types of services we're involved with when we're involved in the full 24-hour wraparound supports that a person needs. Many of these individuals are individuals who live in our group homes, both for children and adults, our foster care programs, and other residential programs. They are, if they're living at home, because we do have some comprehensive services where people are still living at home, they're services that are much more intense than what James referred to that was negotiated under the STALEY agreement, and are involved in in-home staffing, access to jobs, transportation, with a full array of services. We are, across the state, the agencies that we work with are in all of the different communities, and we work with a lot of small agencies. There are 75 agencies who provide residential, group home, supported living type of activities. That means they're individuals who are living in homes that are five persons or smaller with shift care 7 days a week around the clock. So those are the backbone of our community programs for comprehensive services. Other types of services, we also use some supported living, which is individuals who live in their own apartments, but again, due to the nature of their disabilities, require ongoing support throughout the day and into the evening. And the agencies are responsible for that full 24-hour picture. Adults also have access to vocational or day programs, and again, we have 85 agencies who provide that type of service. And those are services where they're working with a person to either try and develop job or access to jobs, and if not in employment, at least in community involvement and being part of their community and having access to the services. With our children, even though the agencies provide 24-hour, we also have a few other types of services. One is a program where we blend foster care and agency services. It's called Proctor Care. What that means is that for some children who have some pretty intensive support needs, almost always around behaviors, that they can benefit from living in a family home and really benefit from the small nature of a family home and being part of a family home, but that family, in order to support them, needs additional resources. They'll need some supports for behavior management, and often they'll need additional staffing. Those are the types of services that constitute the children's programs. We also use foster care for both children and adults. There are 600 individuals who are adults in our foster care program and 230 children in our programs. James mentioned that back in the mid-1990s, there was a transfer of services from the Child Welfare Service to developmental disabilities. And this was to allow families who needed out-of-home services or other more intensive services to get access to that without being part of a protective service or part of a child welfare-related service. So we got involved in actually supporting children across all of those settings. For for individual children who are in out-of-home placement, 50% of those children are still part of child welfare, meaning that they're in the system because not of their disability, but the nature and the circumstances in which their families were unable to manage that care. The other 50% are part of a voluntary, meaning that the individual's needs and supports are so intense that it made it a real challenge for that family to continue serving them. Most of those children are in our group homes, and that's because the individuals are individuals with some very intensive behaviors, a lot of support management needing, not just for the developmental disability, but their mental health issues as well. So we've got a system where we work in partnership with child welfare when that's needed, but most importantly, we're working with families with their children in and out of their homes. James also mentioned a very small program that we have for supporting families with children who either have medical issues or behavioral issues that are very intense. Our children in our medical fragile children's program are those children who otherwise would be living at a hospital level of care. Their needs are great enough that they wouldn't even be moving into nursing homes. They're kids that have ventilator dependency and other technology issues that make their care very challenging to manage. This program lets us ignore the family income and make that child eligible for Medicaid services. So it's a unique program with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that allow us to consider that child's income in of themselves so they can be eligible for Medicaid. And then we can bring supports into the home. And that in that program, it's typically nursing staff, respite staff, and most importantly, access to health care and health care insurance. The second program is similar, only the children in that program are children with intensive behavior support needs. And their behaviors are so involved that it takes full hands-on, eyes-on support of children who typically don't sleep through the night, whose behaviors interfere with not only their sleep but their family's sleep, and really need a lot of additional support. And again, we can ignore the family income, and we can use Medicaid resources as our matching partners there and bring staff into that family home and provide services to those individuals living with their families. Those are two of the programs we've had with Medicaid, each of them of about 100 children each.
Excuse me just a moment. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Has there been an increase in autism, a noticeable increase?
Chair Rossman,
do we know why?
Chair Rossman, Senator Morissette, certainly as we've looked at our increase in demographics, and we are seeing an increase, there is a large increase in the numbers of individuals with autism. You'll hear data from the Centers for Disease Control quote something in the neighborhood of 1 to 150 individuals are individuals or part of the autism spectrum. That's a huge amount. And Oregon is one of four places in the nation that the increase in autism seems higher than elsewhere. People can't tell us exactly why. I think if you could start to say perhaps it's because we are doing a different or more thorough job of eligibility determination, but I don't think that answers the full picture. So there is an increase. We're not sure why. It certainly is one that is going to be one of our drivers as we look at individuals coming into our services, and many of these individuals need some very intense support both in their family home and as they move into adults in the residential programs as well.
Thank you.
Moving on to also staying within our
Thank you. For the population that you just described, the population that takes, because of the safety issues involved, 24-hour care and very close watch over them, can you give us an average cost per case in that type of care?
Chair Wesley, Representative Morgan, when we're supporting families, even with children that are very involved and very intensive, the cost per care is still less than if they were living out of the family home. For children in the program with behavioral support needs, the average monthly cost is in the neighborhood of $3,500 a month. If they're moving into 24-hour residential group homes, that cost jumps up to about $6,000, $7,000 per person per month. So the ability to work with a family is one, what the families want, and is still one of the more cost-effective ways of supporting the individuals.
Thank you.
Chair Russell and members of the committee, the last area in comprehensive that I did want to focus in on is to also let you know that we have a small program that is a state-operated program. It's a program that began when we were moving individuals out of Fairview Training Center and targeted on individuals who, either for some medical issues or behavioral issues, really represented some significant support needs in caring for their needs. They, however, typically individuals with behaviors that were not very stable, that presented a risk to themselves and sometimes to the community, and that we wanted to have a safety net that was part of the system outside of the institution. After Fairview closed, the state-operated community program has maintained that safety net. There are 148 individuals served in that program out of about 5,000. We're talking a very few number of individuals. They're in 32 different group homes, so like our community programs, they're small, they're typically five persons or fewer, and they're in counties, they're in seven different counties, so they're dispersed amongst the communities. In this last biennium, they have really tried to be the safety net. So unlike our other programs where people move in and can think about that as being the lifelong place where they will stay, this is really intended to be a safety net so that as individuals' needs change and improve, they can move back into other community programs. So it really is that there are more people moving out as people move in. In this biennium, we had 21 individuals move out. They left the state-operated programs and moved into our other programs that are run with a private agency, and that meant 21 people came in. And the profile of individuals coming in are really individuals coming in with some co-occurring issues with mental health or criminal issues. Six individuals came directly from a state hospital or a local psychiatric hospital. Six individuals came directly from the correctional facility, either a state correctional facility or a local correctional facility, and others came from within our programs and systems. An average number of placements prior to coming into state operated, there was about 13 different places before they got there. So these are individuals that our system has struggled with in trying to support, and the state operated program has been one that has provided that level of stability. So it is it's truly become a niche program. It is staffed by state employees. Most of these state employees were individuals who worked at Fairview Training Center and when the institution closed, transitioned in, and again represent a very small part of our program.
Mr. Chair.
Sir,
thank you. The corrections part of the population, are these folks who have been or parole, probation, been discharged, they're in transition.
Chair Westland and Senator Gorsuch, all of the above, they're individuals. We work with the Department of Corrections each biennium to try and identify individuals that we know, people who have been case managed in our system with a developmental disability that are incarcerated, that will be coming out during the biennium so we can plan the transition for them at the time they leave the correctional program. So these are individuals that are coming out either having already served a full sentence or coming out early in parole, or they're individuals who ended up with some legal trouble in their local community and they're in local county jails, and rather than where we get involved at that point to try and develop a plan that will help support them. Many individuals are supported in our community programs. They go into our regular group homes. This just represents a very small few who have presented a challenge even to that structure.
And if I may follow up, what do those numbers look like? What are your projections for the upcoming biennium?
Chair Wesson, Senator Gordley, for next biennium, I think we've identified 28 to mid-30s of the individuals who we know about who will be leaving the corrections facility.
Male and female?
Male and female, I would 99% are male.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You didn't mention, but I think I'll make the connection that earlier Mr. Taylor's talked about the agreement with the Department of Justice when we newly terminated Fairview, and this state-operated group home was a part of that, if I can remember correctly, that agreement with the Department of Justice. Because there's often a lot of discussion of why we do have state ops, and that was in the agreement and the settlement that we had with the Department of Justice. Just
Chair Russell and Senator Winters, yes, thank you for reminding us. It was an important piece of the closure of Fairview and has become an important piece of our community system.
Mr. Chair, it might be helpful also if you provide a profile of some of the individuals that are in state-operated group homes and give others, you know, a better understanding of the distinction between the those who are in state-operated group homes and those that are in the private community facilities.
Chair Wesson, Senator Winters will be able to provide that for you.
Thanks.
The one thing I would also add on this is that because this is a program that serves a pretty intense group of individuals, but it's also the most costly program that we run in a community-based program, we're always very aware of those costs. And we have, in the fall, this fall, made some changes and closed one home and reconfigured it to be more effective with how we do our supports, and we also look at contracting. So in the governor's budget, there was a recommendation to reduce one home in order to come up with savings. I think what you'll see when we get into later into our policy option package is, I believe, or in research that you'll see, we have been able to accommodate those without reducing the number of individuals or reducing the number of homes to be served. That makes up the bulk of our comprehensive services, and I'd like to just now switch a little to talk about our support services.
Senator Morissette,
thank you. I guess if we go back to the adult residential program, I understand in Minnville there is a residential home that houses maybe 16 people. Is that correct?
Chair Wilson, Senator Morissette, are you referring to a state-operated home?
Probably not.
Chair Wilson and Senator Morissette, there is an apartment program that was developed in McMinnville that is really around support services, and it's individuals who live in their own apartments who are using funds through our Staley settlement agreement to help in some of their day-to-day support needs.
Was that a pilot project?
Chair Westland, Senator Morissette, the family, I think, worked very creatively with the housing authority to come up with some funds to help purchase and build the apartment program, and worked with our office and their local community program to put the right supports together. And there is an increasing look on how that might fit into the overall picture of our service systems.
Thank you.
On page 42 of this, we start talking about the support services, and I think Mr. Britton might have passed around a handout that shows a graph. The second page of that, the graph that looks like this. And what that represents, as Mr. Caves mentioned, is the growth that we've had in the adult support services as negotiated with the settlement service. And by support services, what we're talking about is that this is capped, financially capped. No individual can receive more than $20,000 a year worth of services. But for the most part, the average is actually less than that. It's an average of no one can receive more than $800 a month or $1,660 per year. And what happens with this is that there are 9 support services brokerages. These are new entities that were developed in 2001 that were meant to be different than county programs. They were part of the services, and their focus was to work with each individual in the support service and really do some planning around what their needs were, how their needs were currently getting met, what supports they needed, and lastly, how state and federal dollars could be used to help support that. So they're looking at it, that state funding was the last thing that came to the table. When we originally settled this, there was a concern that if people had a set amount of money that they would know they could plan to, people would immediately start with how much money they had and spend to the top. But after 6 years, 7 years of this program operating, I'll tell you that the individuals really approach it from looking at all of the support needs that they get not related to state dollars, and state dollars are last. And that's really shown in that the average cost per person in this program is $670 a month, even though they could go higher. So the cost per in this program is typically less than what people would have access to. And I think it's because there's a strong partnership. But what they are purchasing are things that are very critical. The majority of funds are spent in three areas. They're spent on in-home support, so staff that can come into the home and support the person. They're spent in accessing jobs or other community types of programs, and they're spent on respite. The majority of the individuals in this program are still living at home, with their families. So it is a combination of making the support needs work for the individual as well as for the families. Individuals are able to direct how their services are spent. They actually hire individuals directly with the support of their families. They might contract for employment with one of our employment providers. So it's a very self-directed program. When we originally settled in 2001, we thought at the end there would be about 5,000 people enrolled in services, and then we would be in an entitlement program. Because it was resettled, we have until the end of this biennium to still phase in, and we're anticipating 6,000 people to be enrolled in the service by the end of this biennium. We have currently 9 brokerages today. We'll be actually increasing by 2 more brokerages. And again, those are programs that cross different county lines and serve the entire group of state individuals. We just had in February a review from Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services on this program, and I think they were impressed with the accountability that they saw at the brokerage level, but they also saw some of the materials and training that's being used that they are going to put forward as a best practice for the nation on how this program is managed. I think we have seen great ability to support individuals, and it's become a foundation for what we're doing. But in our future, we need to, since the next biennium, it becomes an entitled program. That means that when an individual is eligible, meaning they're over 18 and they have a developmental disability, they will have to have access to the service within 90 days of requesting. So managing the growth, trying to anticipate where our caseload growth is going, going to be a critical component to what we do this biennium so we can accurately predict how this will roll up into our future biennium. The other support services that is not an entitlement is our family support program. And that's serving families with children under age 18 living at home. And each county is given an allocation. It's primarily a grant type of allocation. The state sets out some regulations on what can be purchased with this program, but to date we've had counties able to determine how people get access to service, what the caps amount are, how much they'll be spending for each family, and how long families will stay in those services. Last biennium, we were directed through a budget note to look at all of our children's services and how we could better be addressing some of those needs. And a recommendation from that group is that we apply an even greater standardization than what's there to date. So early this summer, we'll be putting together rules that really identify how people do get access in through the counties and what the set amount, cap amounts will be, so that across the state, families can anticipate what the family support program is, regardless of which community they live in. So the request for us to do more standardization there has happened. These two services, comprehensive and support services, are separated. They become the main area of support services. And I think Mr. Britton passed out a simple chart that tried to demonstrate the flow chart between a comprehensive service, support service, with a crisis in the middle. And as Mr. Case mentioned, the support services for adults is really where the growth has been. It's where we anticipate, because of managing resources. And access to comprehensive services has really been limited to those individuals who need it because they've gone into crisis. And crisis usually means that an individual support network is no longer able to meet their needs. They'd be living with family members who are no longer able to maintain that service. It's a challenging way of getting access to services. And it's been utilized to basically manage the resources that we have. And so that kind of describes the two service settings in the community.
Is that the body language of a question, Representative Nathanson?
No.
If I could, we've got about 9 minutes left, and if you can get through the next couple pages to performance measures, I think that'd be a great place.
I will move on to performance measures. And starting on page 46, the first one is measuring the numbers of individuals that have access.
Mary Lou?
Yes.
I was saying get to.
Okay.
Up to. I did not articulate myself very well.
Well, Chair Wesson, let me go back and explain one more part of our service system that I think is critical.
That's what I'm saying. You've got about 9 minutes.
That's on the institutional care. The majority of services that we've been talking about are how we support people either in their families or in their own home, or how we support them when we need full 24-hour. And there are still some small areas where we use institutional supports, primarily nursing facilities and Eastern Oregon Training Center. Eastern Oregon Training Center is an institutional care facility for mentally retarded. That's how Fairview was licensed. And so it has a separate federal licensing and federal reporting requirements. And it has been, it was back in the 80s, it went through some changes where it was a larger institution and was designed and built to accommodate up to 90 individuals. And from that time, the population has been declining. And in fact, in the last 10 years, we have not had admissions at Eastern, with the exception of a period of time where they did crisis supports for us. So the training center, which is located in Pendleton, currently supports 40 individuals. The governor's budget originally had identified and recommended closure, and since that time we have reinstated the budget for that with us to really look at how we will continue to look at closure as an option, but also look at the facility out there and its best use in being able to have meet other needs within the department. There are certainly both a campus and a group of staff are very qualified to be supporting individuals, and as we look at options in the community and other support needs, whether it's in the mental health arena or other arenas, the governor's asked us to be planful on how we would look at doing that. So our budget today includes.
Answer part of my question. I just would like to ask, what kind of timeline are you looking at to answer the questions that the governor has posed of when we can really talk about the development of community resources and the exit from the facility?
Chair Wilson, Senator Winters, the governor has already appointed a committee to start looking at the issues of how we might look at alternative uses as well as what would need to take place in order to help support individuals move. I believe there is not a set date timeline, but certainly the expectation is that we would have plans within this biennium, if not actual opportunities to make some changes within this biennium.
Okay.
Chair Wesley, Senator Winters, I think Dr. Goldberg sent a letter to Senator Nelson and Representative Jensen indicating we think, assuming we can plan all the transition steps, we would contemplate sort of ending it as a facility for just people with developmental disabilities by the end of next, by the 09-11 biennium. That's roughly the projection.
So by the 09 or 09-11?
Correct.
So it's 09-11?
Correct.
Senator Gordley.
How does the co-chair's budget treat this?
Chair Westland and Senator Gordley, actually the co-chairs restored. There was only a small reduction because of the phase-in, phase-out, and the parallel costs of slightly in excess of $1 million, I think, was a reduction of general fund in the governor's budget that was actually included or restored in the co-chair's budget.
Thank you.
In terms of the budgetary impacts, this biennium, under the governor's initial proposal, or ours, the co-chairs, I mean, they're fairly, there's not much difference. But in terms of the public policy discussion, I guess that's what I'm saying, is this is actually a discussion that we can have without huge budget impacts one way or another, and have it in the more, I think, fertile, productive arena of the actual public policy. Well, there's good points on both sides of this issue.
Maybe the last institutional reference that I wanted to make was towards nursing homes, and it's actually two components. The first is that we still have a number of children who are living in nursing homes, and there are anywhere from 60 to 70 children who are using nursing homes. We have been rewriting some rules that would have the state office be more involved in every admission, so that the opportunity to develop services outside of a nursing home is something we can engage with a family prior to those admissions. So we are more actively involved in that, and in July we'll actually have a position that will focus on coming up with options to help families in thinking about support services, whether it's respite that they're looking for or a more longer-term stay that could be options outside of or different than the nursing home, so that people are at least understanding what their options are in that arena. For adults with developmental disabilities, there are still there are about 100 individuals who are adults living in nursing homes, and we have, through federal regulations, been providing a general fund only component called specialized services. This is a budget item that's been eliminated in the governor's budget, and what this really did was enhanced and said if somebody was in the nursing home and they needed additional supports, we would provide anything from what turned into a lot of social interaction, maybe a little bit of community support. This is a federal regulation, so we can't eliminate the federal regulation, but Oregon has been very broad in how it's defined its services. And so what we will be doing is redefining the services and mostly offering people an opportunity to not have to live in the nursing home and move into the community if indeed they really feel like they can benefit from community services. So we hope to be working more closely again with some adults who have moved into nursing homes, maybe as a part of rehab, but then ended up staying there.
Can I ask a question? Does People First still exist?
Chair Wilson, Senator Winters, yes, they do, and they're very active along with a group called Self Advocates as Leaders.
Madam Chair.
Exactly. We almost got through that. You were reading James's mind. This is not your fault, Senator Winter. It's James's. Remember when you had the all-women's caucus and somebody showed up?
Yes, I remember that well. But it would be nice if the chair or the president of that organization, if we could hear from them. It's a long-standing organization, and I could still recall when some of the issues that we're talking about now were just ones that were kind of a dream. And so I can still remember the dance that was held at the Hilton Hotel in downtown. I think it was Hilton Sheraton in downtown Portland, and the shock to the community. So I'd like to, if we have public testimony, to invite the president from People First.
I think we're at a good break point. Any further questions? Anything for the good of the order? The committee, I'd call all of our attentions to the chart on page 44, where it just simply but profoundly enumerates all of the individuals that are served, people who are in the DD community. There's 15,644 human beings. And while they are very fortunate to have the likes of Mary Lou and Mr. Taves represent them at the department level, and I see some of the community home and operators in the audience today, what they are most fortunate to have are those employees that on a daily basis tend to the needs and do jobs that are as thankless as they are monetary and rewarding. I know there's huge satisfaction in those jobs for the employees, but it's the employees that really make this system work. And I think that's where we need to spend some of our time as we look at these budgets. Committee, thanks for a great hearing. James, Mary Lou, thank you. We are adjourned.